Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to another new episode of the Declutter Me podcast with myself, Shalina. This week, my guest is Claire Anderson of Clutter Free and Organized. Claire is a board certified behavior analyst and the founder of Clutter Free. She spent 15 years in America working in various exciting jobs, which we're going to discuss shortly. And in 2014, she returned to the UK and did a master's in behavior analysis. Now, in addition to being a professional declutterer, she is a behavior analyst specializing in ASD and autism. So welcome, Claire, to the Declutter Me podcast.
Hi, Shalina. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. So this is so exciting. So, I mean, we've talked recently because I had a client with ASD. And then when we started talking, I was like, we need to chat more with this, you know, and I'm sure it's going to help lots of people. But you have such a diverse background. So tell me first, what were you doing before you became an organizer?
I started off in hospitality. I worked in London for a couple of years in restaurant management. And then I moved to the States and went into yachting, which is like restaurant management, but very, very luxurious, very, very, you know, six star, if you will. And I did that for a really, really long time. So I started off as a stewardess and then became a purser, which is a bit like running a hotel, but it's a floating, very fancy hotel.
Yeah.
So I worked all over the world, and the guys I worked for had very big estates, and I ended up working land-based as well for a short period of time. And it was great. It was really, really good. I did that until 2011 when my son was born. Really difficult job to do with a child. So I left and came back to the UK.
Oh, wow. And so what spurred you to take a master's in behavior analysis? And what is it?
So behavior analysis is it's a scientific approach to behavior. So we see everything that a human does as behavior. What we feel is behavior. Everything we do, sleeping is behavior. Eating is a behavior. If we treat everything as behavior, it's very easy to strip that down to its basic tenets, and then you can create an intervention based on that. I got into this field simply because my child was diagnosed with autism at the age of two.
Right. Okay.
So I did a lot of research on how to help a child who had autism. He was really quite severe. They told me he would never speak and never go to normal school. He would be probably in residential care. I mean, the outlook was very, very gloomy for us. So, and I'm quite stubborn and was prepared to accept that. So I did a lot of research and looked at a ton of different interventions, from the wacky to the scientific. And yeah. ABA, which is what we call applied behavior analysis, is really struck a chord with me because it's got a very, very scientific, it's empirically based.
Right.
And it's a very sound approach. There's no guesswork, there's no anecdotes, it's all scientific method. So I employed experts who could help me, but I decided very quickly that I wanted to be the expert in my child's life and not employ someone else. If there was a way to help him, it was me that was going to do it. So The only way to do that was to become board certified. So I went back to university. I studied for 3 years, and then you have to do like 1,000 clinic hours before you can sit the big boards exam. And So now I'm board certified. So it helped me help him immensely. But then I was able, obviously, to turn it into a career as well, which I'm still doing.
That's amazing. And it's so useful as well. And there's not that many people who've done it as well to use it.
Here in the UK, it's becoming a bigger field, but it's still very difficult to find professionals. And the cost is very prohibitive for many, many families, which is a real shame.
I know that people like fly over here to help people as well. Yeah. So it is a thing. So then what made you become start Clutter Free and become an organizer, you know, after doing this?
So it's a really overwhelming job sometimes. When I go to a new client for the first time, it's a highly emotive environment. They've often just had a diagnosis. They're terrified. And I know exactly how that feels because I've been in their shoes.
Yeah.
So every day when I go, I live with ASD at home, do the best I can for my son, and then I go to work and I live ASD at work. And it became, I guess I got burnt out. It became really draining, and I felt that I wasn't giving 100% because I was just so, it's overwhelmed and sad all the time. So post-pandemic, I thought, you know, maybe I should just cut my hours down, take on less clients. And then all of a sudden, a friend asked me in the new year, just this year, to help her sort out her kitchen. And then another friend asked me to help sort out her garage because I'm known for being the organized one.
Right, okay.
And I suddenly thought, oh, this reminds me of my old job. You know, I would go to a new yacht and they'd ask me to, you know, reorganize the yacht and detach the yacht. And I thought, oh, why don't I just do this? You know, it just seemed to all click together. So I created a website, did some Instagram posts, did a bit of a blog, and by February I was up and running.
Oh,
and
amazing.
I'm so busy now, I'm rushed off my feet. It's really, really good.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, yeah, touch wood.
Yeah. Touch wood, keep going, yeah.
But are you using, so now though, you can use your organizing skills with your, you know, the ASD skills that you've learned, I mean the behavior and analysis skills you've learned as well?
Yeah, they all magically fit together really, really quite well.
Yeah, yeah.
So I often find that when I approach a declutter project with my behavior analysis hat on, it's quite easy to take the emotion out of it for me and for the client.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I say to them, you know, when you start, you have to look at this like a project, you know, look at these things as just project things. Decide what you need for your project and what you don't need for your project. And it makes us be able to get through the decluttering system quite easily. It doesn't work for every single client because obviously everybody's different, you know, but it helps me to approach it that way because then I don't get, decluttering is, you know, as you know, it can be highly emotive. And if I don't get caught up in that, I can keep my behavior hat on and talk using my behavior analysis steps. So that's actually quite useful.
That's really good because, it can be, it is very emotionally tiring. And I say it to clients, they're going to be mentally tired and physically tired. Yeah. And sometimes with certain clients, it can be emotionally draining for me as well. So, I need to watch a lot of real housewives to sort of decompose. I was going to say, have you seen Below Deck as well? Have you seen that?
Oh, I have. I'm not a fan.
I wonder why.
Our crew was actually approached about 14 years ago if we wanted to actually be part of that project when it first started. There was a lot of buzz about it. And the owner of our boat said if we even spoke to the producers, we'd all be fired. So, that's not...
That was good.
Yeah, and every single colleague of mine on other boats, all our friends, they were all told the same. You do not talk to the producers. They weren't allowed on the docks. They were refused entry into most marinas.
Oh, really?
So so the kind of people that you see when you watch Below Decks, it's not really indicative of what's going on in the industry, shall we say?
I can imagine,
It's a bit like the Love Island of yachting. It's not. I don't think any of those people would probably get a job on another yacht.
I'm sure they won't. So anyway, let's get away from real life TV. Well, semi-real life. So I wanted to talk to you about ASD because of, you know, your experience and because we've been chatting. And there's so much we can talk about, but let's talk about children and the experience you have in relation to decluttering and organizing them. So what is a typical age of diagnosis and the struggles that you see when working with families who've got diagnosed children with ASD?
So diagnosis can happen anytime from sort of two onwards. And depending on where you are in the world or in the country in the UK, the diagnosis system is different.
Right.
So here where I live, it's a multifaceted approach. It takes people from education psychology, pediatricians, health visitors, all of those people have to submit their own reports as well with a parent report. Put those all together, it goes to a review panel. They review it twice. This can take up to 2 years. And since the pandemic, the waiting list is even longer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you will probably, if it gets that far, you're probably going to get a diagnosis because they will tell you where I am if they think that there's actually something else going on.
Right.
Before the pandemic, it was quite easy to get a diagnosis. And now it's incredibly difficult. The age is quite dependent on how the ASD presents. A big factor of ASD is that you have a child who has a massive speech delay. But my child didn't speak at all until he was almost at school. Not at all. We had to teach every single word to him.
Right.
When you get a 2.5-year-old that's not speaking any words whatsoever, a diagnosis is really quite straightforward because that's such a massive indicator. But when you get a child who has very high verbal skills and very high cognitive skills, that diagnosis might not happen until they're in their teens because the ASD has been there all the time, but it's not really visible until they start to struggle in more advanced social settings. When you have a child who's diagnosed much, much later, the intervention process can actually be more difficult, not less difficult, because they've had so many years of not getting any help. And they start to hide what they feel is autism because they recognize that they are different to other children. So it presents a lot of challenges, no matter how. When you first find out that your child's autistic, your goal is to have them speak. You want them to be able to speak, and you think that all the problems will go away once that happens. And unfortunately, that is not the case. There's a lot of other things going on. So the range of difficulties that I'm asked to help with are primarily speaking.
Right.
Because children who are not able to communicate their needs have the most immense frustration, and that is demonstrated in tantrums and sensory meltdowns because they can't describe how they're feeling or what they want. So those are probably the big three. After that, I would say sleep problems, eating problems. They have lack of play skills, lack of social skills, lack of academic help. Because if you've got a child who can't demonstrate skills through voice, they often get skipped over in school because they're assumed that they don't understand. Whereas that's actually not the case at all. Often children who are unable to communicate with you and understand everything that's going on around them, they just can't demonstrate that.
And they usually have amazing skills in certain field that they have to find out, isn't it? You know, like they're creative or maths, you know. I've heard the terms ASC and ASD. What is the difference?
ASD is autism spectrum disorder. That's the medical term. So whenever you look, if a parent looks at any records from hospital or pediatrician, they're going to see ASD.
Right.
So ASC is autism spectrum condition. And that is more a term that is used by parents and organizations that are trying to be very inclusive. Because just because you have autism doesn't actually mean you have a disorder. It is listed as disability, and which is actually not a bad thing because it means because it's a disability that parents are often able to access funding and help that they wouldn't be able to otherwise. But the language about autism can be really, really emotive. So we used to say autistic children, and now we're more likely to say child with autism.
Right, okay.
People used to say that the child suffered from autism, and that is now considered not the case because it's not something that you just not like suffering from cancer. It's something that you, it's a lifelong condition that you can adapt to.
Right, okay.
So the language can be quite difficult. And then the other really tricky one is that it's very tempting often to talk about the child with autism versus the normal child.
Right,
which you can imagine when you're constantly as a parent being told that your child is not normal, that can be quite harsh. So we tend to use the word neurotypical and neurodiverse.
Right. Okay. Yes, I've heard those terms.
And some parents really don't care about the language. They just want you to help their child as best as possible. Some parents are really, really strong about the kind of language. So as a declutterer going into one of these families, I would suggest that you sit down and say, what are the terms that you want me to use and don't want me to use, just so I don't cause offense? And most families, you know, they've lived with this for a while. They'll have a very frank conversation with you about the language they prefer.
Right. Okay. But I mean, I've had from experience, you know, parents that are told they're new into this. They've just got the diagnosis. They've been told to change the family home and create safe places. And I mean, I didn't know about the terms. So this is good to know. But they're straight away thrown into it that you have to change the home. You have to create a play area, a sensory area. So what is the best way to start the journey? Because it's a minefield for them, you know, as well as dealing with the fact that, you know, they've had this diagnosis, you know, given to them as well.
Yeah. So there's often this generic guide about autism that a lot of professionals think it's a one fit all situation. Yeah. Autism's a spectrum. So what is true for my child with autism is very different from some of his friends with autism. You know, it's some adults you would never know that they had autism. It's very much a hidden disability. And other adults, it's very obvious that they need help. So it has to be approached on a very individual level. There's no cookie cutter solutions to this. So if a family is told you need to make safe places, you need to make sensory room, you need to do this, you need to do this, that might not be the case for that particular family. And if they go in and make all those changes, they can create more trauma than is already there. Because change is hard for any child.
Yeah.
So I would say any changes need to be made slowly. Even a good change made too quickly can create trauma.
Right.
I would say that you need to, if possible, talk to the child's closest environmental people. So talk to the nursery. What do they play with at nursery? Because that might be totally different than what they do at home.
Right.
You need to talk to grandma. What do they enjoy doing at your place? Because that might be different at home. Mm-hmm. And then take all of these things and use that information to create the safe place and the sensory place.
Right. Okay.
When you create a safe place, you have to really consider things like elopement and escape, climbing, mouthing. Children with autism will often put things in their mouth that neurotypical children will grow out of doing that, but an ASD child might not.
Right.
And self-harm also is, it can be not self-harm in the way we talk about it as a trauma response for a neurotypical person, but many severely autistic children don't recognize pain the way we do, and they don't display the way they feel pain the way we do.
Right.
They hurt themselves with things accidentally, but not actually have the understanding of pain to tell you where they are injured. So you have to be careful about what's in your safe place and in your sensory room.
Oh, wow. You know, I just didn't even think of that. Like, yeah, that's...
There's a lot going on, isn't there?
Yeah. But as you said, it's a spectrum. So, I mean, I've dealt with people on the spectrum, and I even had a client recently who was 30 and just been diagnosed. So, and it's different for everyone. So it's difficult to navigate that.
But just in terms of the sensory rooms, the big thing about that is that we often think of sensory as lights and flashing things and spinning things, but one person's sensory wonderland can be another person's sensory torture chamber. Yeah. So you really have to design a sensory room based on what the kid needs. You can't assume that because they are on the spectrum that flashy light up things are pleasant.
Yeah.
I've come across kids that fidget spinner is like, it's basically like juggling knives. They couldn't think of anything worse.
Because a lot of them are being given. I think that's a good thing to think about because all of them recently I've seen they've got fidget spinners. And I was like, I thought this was out of fashion, but they're all using it. But as you said, it might not be the right thing for them, you know.
Yeah.
So you talk to me about social stories, and I know talking to clients, they'd never heard of it as well. And this is when, then I researched after we talked to explain social stories, because it's so incredibly useful for parents and for the kids as well, isn't it?
Social stories are great for any age, and they're actually really good for children that aren't on the spectrum as well, that are going into new environments. So the first social story I ever used for my child was a transition from one class in his nursery to the other.
Right.
And his nursery were incredibly well informed on ASC, and they actually helped me to put this into place. So they took real life pictures of the room he was in, and they did a short video of going into the room that he's now going to be in. And they took a picture of his coat place with his name above it, where his books would go, where he would eat lunch, a picture of where he would do painting, a picture of where his new playground was. And they put it into a little booklet. And we sat down and did it with him in the nursery. And then I did it with him at home once a day. And then leading up to him starting, we would take him and the little book into the nursery, and we'd show him the picture and then show him the real life thing.
Oh, wow, that's amazing.
And it worked really well. He was sort of familiar with it. It's like when you go to the website and you Google all the images you can about the hotel you're going to on your next vacation.
Yeah.
That's basically you creating your own social story.
Yeah.
Where are we going to eat dinner? What does the beach look like? So but these are becoming more and more popular. Airlines do them now for children who have never flown or autistic adults who have never flown.
They're
really, really helpful. So a social story for decluttering could be pictures taken within the family home, showing what it would look like to take something and put it in a box and then take it to the car and then take it to the charity shop or take it to the donation station or give it away or take it to the tip. So it would show every step of the process. And it would be just one item, I would say, not boxes full of stuff.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to explain very carefully that we're only going to get rid of the things we don't need. So you show a picture of a toy that we don't play with anymore. And you could put a line through it or something, or you could fold it to show that that's gone. Then you'd put that picture in the box, and then you'd show the box going. And then the next social story could be the actual object in the box.
Right.
And then
going to...
And you'd practice that until you felt you had a sense that the child understood what that meant. And then you'd do it with the real thing.
Wow, that's amazing. Because, I mean, when I was working with that client and, you know, we discussed it, you know, you said, some children are happy to be involved, you know, a lot of children are not. And I mean, I know working with children that some just have to be away. It's painful for them to be there because they want to go through the toys again, or they're just, you know, noisy. Whereas this child wanted to be involved, which was surprising even
Fantastic.
For me.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing session because then we, you know, I became her Auntie Shalina. Like, you know, I've got another little niece now because she just wanted to be by my side and we went through everything together. And I like explaining to people that we're giving it to poor people, you know, to people who are less fortunate than them. And she loved that story that it's, and I mean, it's reality, not even a story, that we're just going to give the toys to somebody who needs the toys more than her. And that she's got these amazing toys and her room was going to get changed as well because it was very old and the parents wanted to change it up as well. But what is your thoughts, you know, with the transition, I suppose, of decluttering and organizing in bedrooms with kids?
That word transition is a huge word for people on the spectrum. Transition for someone on the spectrum is moving from one location to the other. And right. It can be them moving to the location. And we can be talking moving from, like, say, my table here to the sofa over there. That is a transition. We're not talking about going from house to house. It can be a very small step that is completely overwhelming.
Right.
So when you think that the transition is not just someone moving, but an object moving, you would really have to practice with the child with a lot of patience to see where their tolerance lies.
Right.
Now, you can actually build that tolerance up in small steps, which I think is a really important thing to do, because being able to declutter and then organize your space is a life skill. It's not just something that I think people should do every couple of years when they get bored. It's an ongoing project. And if you can teach that to a child who is on the spectrum, you built a lifelong skill for them that they will need to keep helps them keep their sanity. Having a clear, uncluttered home is a really, really calming effect. So if a child is open to that process, that is fantastic. If they're not open to that process, then you need to teach it.
Right. Okay.
And the way you teach it is like with the social story, one item at a time. And then you do a room at a time or a cupboard at a time, just to show them that transition is manageable.
Right.
If you desperately need to declutter and you've got a child that can't tolerate it, what I would do is show them a before and after of a different home to show what it can look like before and after, and say, now we're going to do that here. Take the child out and then show them. iPhones are great for this. Before they go back into the house, you can show them on the phone, what does the house look like now?
Yeah.
So that when they walk in, they're prepared for that.
Yeah, so they don't have the shock.
And it makes that transition less stressful.
Right, okay, I think that's a good thing to do because, then it's too much for their heads, isn't it? That if they see their new room and it's just completely changed and everything's gone, they think everything's gone, even if it's organized properly into proper systems. So this is amazing. So what are your top tips to get people started with decluttering and organizing, especially, you know, when they've got kids with ASD?
definitely start small. I would suggest that if it's specifically the child's room you want to start with, have them pick a single drawer or a single little box. Mm-hmm. Children on the spectrum tend to collect really, really random things. I worked with a family a long time ago who are no longer my clients, so I can talk about them. But they had never decluttered, and they had a early teen who had kept every little bit of anything he'd ever been given in his life. So you couldn't even walk into his room. It was so decluttered. Yeah. So cluttered, definitely needed help. So he had a box. You know those old little toys you used to get with the Happy Meals? I don't know if they
still have them.
Collect them. So he had a huge, huge box full of these.
Right.
And at the bottom, you can imagine they were like decade old. They were all broken and cracked. So their first project was to throw away the broken ones.
Yep.
And what they found really quickly was that they spent like a week doing like two broken ones at a time.
Right.
And by the end of the week, this was a natural project for him. It was like, oh, let's do the box.
Right.
And by the end of the week, he was doing it without any prompting. He practiced it. He was doing it. And then he actually decided of his own will to go through and throw all the ones away that were blue.
That's good.
He decided the blue wasn't the color he wanted anymore, and then he decided that he didn't want the green ones, and so he was left with probably 50%.
Yeah.
And he then picked out a shelf and arranged them all beautifully on his shelf, so they became like a collection.
Yeah.
So now they're decluttered, and he's organized them.
That's amazing. And now they're worth a lot of money, most probably as well. So
That's amazing. So start small. Start with a project that the child definitely has an interest in.
Right.
I would say never do it without them knowing.
Okay.
Because children with ASC often fixate on things, and they won't necessarily demonstrate what they're fixated on until you've made the decision for them. Like they could have a box under the bed that's old and dusty. They might check that it's there every single day, but you don't know they're doing that.
Yeah.
So if they come back and it's not there, that's a very traumatic thing.
Yeah.
So it needs to be done with the child, and it definitely needs to be done in a very open and honest way. But again, it's a life skill, so it's worth putting the time in.
Yeah. And if they can be involved, then as you said, it will set them up for life. And I think that's the same for any kid, that if they can be involved
absolutely.
In the process, it's always good. Sorry, my cat's decided to join. So this is a good time. Finally, tell me, how can people get in touch with you? What areas do you cover in the UK? You know, tell us everything, how to get in touch.
So I'm based in Chester, and I cover most of the Northwest. So that would be North Wales, we're all South Manchester, Shrewsbury, and all around there.
Awesome.
I've got a website which I can put on the link if you like, and I'm always available by phone and text. And I've got links on Facebook and Instagram as well.
Awesome. So I'm going to put your website address on the show notes as well, so people can get in touch. And one day, finally, I'll come to that side of the world. I've never. It's very embarrassing. I'm from Kent, and I've never been to Wales or Scotland or Ireland. So I will, and then I'll come and visit you.
Fabulous.
I'm so embarrassed.
And bring the cat, he's cute.
No, he's lovely, but it's a pain in the ass. But thank you so much for being on the show. Talk about this. It's so interesting and so helpful, and there's so many people that need the help nowadays. I'm seeing more and more diagnoses is happening, especially here as well in the UAE. Thank you so much. Thanks everybody for listening. I hope you found it incredibly useful, and have a listen next week for the next episode. Thanks a lot again. Take care. Bye.